20s, is there more than one galaxy in the universe? Okay. Some people thought that what appear to be galaxies to us today were actually just nebulae. They were just clouds of gas and stars on the outskirts of one galaxy. So a lot of the work in the early 20s about cosmology was based on the assumption there was just one ball of matter in the universe, and asymptotically it would be Minkowski. Okay? Einstein tried to, so basically with no data, he tried to make a consistent cosmology, right? Which, and I'll explain how he did that. There's one way. Now, yeah, Einstein himself could not conceive that the universe was expanding or contracting. It didn't really make any sense. I mean, that would mean there was a beginning or an end, okay? Which both sound bad. And so Einstein expected the universe would be static, right? Should just be sitting there, it's got some matter in it, and it's lasts forever. So that's the first thing he tried to do, and I'll explain to you what the Einstein static universe is, how he discovered it, and what's wrong with it, and why, in fact, it was what he called the biggest mistake of his life, to create this static universe. Because, in fact, his field equations predict that the universe is either expanding or contracting. And so that was a great prediction of general relativity, but it was such a kind of bold prediction that even Einstein couldn't accept it initially, or it wasn't obvious to him. So all we do is let's translate this equation into an equation for the size of the universe. So now we're going to consider a homogeneous and isotropic universe. So you've already done the homework on this, right? I believe you did this for your last homework. You considered a metric minus dt squared plus a squared of t dx squared. Okay, where A is some function of time. And this describes a flat space, just flat Euclidean space, dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared, but where I just blow up the scale of the space. Yeah? We'll see. We'll see. Yeah. You'll see exactly what the static universe is. So that's what you did for the homework. But we're going to do something slightly more general, because this is 3D flat space, which is also called E3. Okay, Euclidean three-dimensional space, just the space of high school geometry. Okay? We're going to consider something more generally, or the most general case, in fact, is that we have, consistent with homogeneity and isotropy, is this gamma ij dxi dxj. This is the spatial metric. Okay, where gamma ij equals the metric for, and then there are three cases, E3, which is flat space, flat three-dimensional space, or we can have S3, which is a three-sphere, or we can have H3, which is a 3 hyperboloid. Okay, so this is the most general set of possibilities if I insist on homogeneity. Homogeneity means that every point in space is the same as every other point in space. Isotropy means that the universe is isotropic around every point in space. Yeah.
Why you cannot have another kind of three-manifold?
Not a simple argument, but if you look in Steven Weinberg's book, for example, there's a proof. Basically, you do it by finding Killing vectors. And the formal definition is it's the space with the maximum number of Killing vectors allowed in that dimension. And these are the only possibilities. So, but you know, it's plausible. So let me just define these things. So three sphere, of course, S3 just means the manifold plus Z squared plus U squared, let's say, equals 1. So that's a unit three sphere in E4. And H3 will be something like T squared minus X squared minus Y squared minus Z squared equals 1 in 4D Minkowski. This is Minkowski. Okay, so what a hyperboloid, of course, is something like this, that if I just did this in one dimension, Tx, whoops, that's a hyperboloid, T squared equals X squared plus 1. So a three-dimensional hyperboloid looks like this. You just take a sphere and put a minus sign in front of some of the components. And this, the metric on H3 is just the one induced from a metric on 4D Minkowski space. So we actually won't need these metrics in detail, what they are on S3 and H3. We will only need one property of them, which is that the Ricci scalar, so for these three cases, the Ricci scalar of the three-dimensional metric, so just take this as a 3D space, calculate its Ricci scalar, and this is either 0 or, for a sphere, it is 6, and for a hyperboloid, it's minus 6. Yeah?
Why is there only a minus 1 in front of dt squared?
Because the signature is minus plus plus plus. It's locally Minkowski space. Any spacetime in GR must be locally Minkowski space. So it always must have signature minus plus plus plus.
Okay, but why isn't it the more complicated fact, like
in front of T?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm not going to prove this, but it's actually not hard to prove it, because if I had some more complicated fact, you see, the statement is that it is always possible to choose coordinates like this. That's all. So if I put some factor here, minus function of t, dt squared, okay, that has to be positive. So I can write it as f squared. And then this, then I just define this to be minus dt squared. So dt is f t dt. And that gives me the integral. So that gives me t as a function of t. So you can get rid of it with a coordinate transformation. The other thing you might worry about is, could there be a cross term? Could there be a dx dt, dxi dt vi of x and t, for example? But you see, any vector in space would break isotropy as a special direction. So that term is ruled out by isotropy. So in fact, this is the most general possibility consistent with homogeneity and isotropy. So obviously the universe isn't homogeneous and isotropic, but it's approximately homogeneous and isotropic. Okay, there's the distribution of matter through the universe on large scales is pretty uniform. In Einstein's time, that was just an assumption. Right? He had no data. So, in fact, all he had was data showing us our galaxy, the Milky Way and a few nebulae outside it. He had no evidence the universe was homogeneous and isotropic, but he thought that was maybe a reasonable assumption. Okay, so this was known, and then the Ricci scalar is known. And now I'm just going to give you the field equations, which I think you've already worked out, right? The G naught naught, the Einstein field equations, just these ones. So you've already worked this out for the flat case, and I'll just tell you what they are for the curved case. So it turns out that the most interesting one is this one, and everything else follows from it. And this equation, so all the other Einstein equations are automatically satisfied, providing this one is, for the special case of homogeneous isotropic universes. And this is called the Friedmann equation. Okay, where dot is d by dt, and we write the three Ricci scalar, I just write as 6k, that's the definition of k. Okay, so k is equal to 0 plus 1 minus 1 for E3, S3, H3. And rho is the density. Rho equals the density. So this equation is called the Friedmann equation. And this is the most important equation in cosmology, and was discovered by a Russian mathematician, Alexander Friedmann, who essentially proved that with this assumption about homogeneity and isotropy, the universe had to be expanding or contracting. Einstein actually thought initially Friedmann's result was wrong and disputed it for about 6 months in correspondence. He thought he'd just done the, so he'd made a mistake. And finally he was convinced that Friedmann was right, and then he basically made the statement that his static universe was a big mistake. It's not really a mistake, in fact, but it's not quite right either. In addition to this equation, we of course have the conservation of stress energy. Okay, and we're going to assume the stress energy is a perfect fluid. Yeah.
What are we assuming for QEU?
I'm just about to say it. So the stress energy has to be conserved, and we're assuming that T mu nu is P plus rho U nu plus P G mu nu. I hope I've got that right. So that's what your first homework was, all about this stress tensor. Okay? In this case, it's rather easy for homogeneous isotropic metrics. It's rather easy to get the U mu. Sorry, yep.
Are we now setting in C equals 1?
Yeah, we are. Sorry about that. Oh, you like that?
Yes.
Yeah. We're now setting C equals 1. Sorry. My apologies. My principles have deteriorated. So C is 1. U mu, the square of the 4 velocity has to be minus 1. Okay? What is the 4 velocity? Well, the 4 velocity has got to be something in the 0 component and then a spatial vector. But the assumption of isotropy means there's no special vector. No special spatial vector. So that's got to be 0. Okay? And so now when I calculate g mu nu u nu equals minus 1, that forces u0 to be 1. Okay, so that's really easy. The 4 velocity is just 1, 0 for a fluid in the universe. So u mu is just 1, 0 in these coordinates. And So now you can easily work out T naught naught. So T naught naught is just P plus rho times U naught squared minus P. So T naught naught is rho. And if you work out this equation, this is also easy. You've worked out all the, I think you may have done this in the homework. This equation is just rho dot is minus 3 A dot over A P plus rho. Okay, so these are the two equations you need to discuss the most general cosmology, where the matter in the universe is described by a perfect fluid with some pressure and some density. So now I'm just going to discuss the generic solution of these equations, okay, in the following way. Well, actually, let me discuss solutions of this first. So this is quite easy to analyze in some special cases. So one, let's do matter or dust, sometimes called dust. That is a fluid with almost zero pressure, just like a cloud of particles, which the particles aren't moving around. So there's no pressure. This has P equals zero. And then this equation implies that rho is proportional to A to the minus 3. Okay, rho dot is minus 3A dot over A rho, just implies that rho is a constant times A to the minus 3. And that's a very nice interpretation, that I take a volume of space and I expand it by a factor A in linear dimension, so the volume grows like A cubed, and the density goes like 1 over A cubed, okay, because the mass in the volume is conserved. If we take radiation, okay, then P is one-third rho, and again, you derive that in the first homework set for radiation, and this implies that rho goes like A to the minus 4. Because now I have P equals one-third rho, so rho dot is minus 4 A dot over A rho, and so rho goes like A to the minus 4. The additional factor of 1 over A is nothing but the redshifting of the radiation as the universe expands. The energy of every photon goes like its frequency, but the frequency is the inverse wavelength, and the wavelength's going with the size of the universe. So that the energy in a given volume of the universe will go like 1 over A, and then the volume's going like A cubed, so the density goes like A to the minus 4. The third case is for a cosmological constant. Okay, and so that is that's actually what we believe the vacuum energy is, the energy of empty space, where you have no matter or radiation. And that's a very easy term, because that is given by T mu nu is minus lambda G mu nu. It has to take that form. The stress energy has to be proportional to the metric, because in any inertial coordinate system, the main property of vacuum energy is that it is Lorentz invariant. Okay, so I've got some energy in this room. Doesn't matter if I'm traveling with some speed with respect to it, the energy shouldn't change. If it's Lorentz invariant, it shouldn't change. And so actually in flat space, the stress energy is proportional to eta mu nu. That's the only Lorentz invariant two-index symmetric tensor that there is. So that's all it can be. And therefore in curved space, it's got to be g mu nu. So this quantity lambda is called a cosmological constant. And Einstein realized that he could introduce that into the field equations. He kind of thought of it as a geometrical term rather than a stress energy. But you can just nowadays we interpret this as the energy of the vacuum. It's the energy of empty space. Now from this you can read off, you see if T mu nu is G mu nu, then obviously this term is zero. So P is minus rho, and P is equal to minus lambda. So the pressure is equal to minus rho equals minus lambda. And so the density is actually lambda. So that's vacuum energy. And that's independent of A. And you can check this energy conservation equation. If P is minus rho, the right-hand side is 0, so rho dot is 0. So that's consistent. Lambda is a constant. So this is the most bizarre kind of energy, because as the universe expands, the energy density remains fixed, but the volume is growing like A cubed. So this is sometimes called a free lunch. If you have a cosmological constant or vacuum energy, you just keep creating energy, more and more and more energy, just because you're creating more and more space, and the energy density is constant. Yeah?
Can the cosmological constant vary?
Then it wouldn't be called a cosmological constant. So, no, you see, this quantity conserves energy. In the sense it's covariantly constant, right? This is covariantly constant because the metric is covariantly constant, but only if lambda is a constant. If you make lambda a function of x, you won't conserve energy. We won't have local conservation of energy. So now you see that the concept of global energy is not the same as local energy. And this, even though this satisfies local stress energy conservation, globally the energy is growing like A cubed. Okay? It's very dramatic. Yeah?
Is this what led Fred Hoyle to propose that state universe?
Yes. Yes. So this is the basis for Fred Hoyle's proposal of a steady state universe. Steady state universe is just one dominated by lambda. And actually, you can see from here, if lambda dominates, and ignore the curvature for the moment. The solution is, what's the solution of this equation? A dot is proportional to A. What's the solution? Exponential. Okay? So if lambda, if you have a universe with only lambda, you get exponential growth. That's the basis for steady state universe, the basis for the inflationary universe. You know, there are only a small number of basic ideas in physics and they get recycled. So, and the solution of that space-time is called De Sitter space-time. A space-time with only a lambda is called De Sitter space. And it basically grows exponentially in size. It's a very sort of fundamental space. Probably Nima talked about De Sitter space. What? Only anti-De Sitter. Okay. Anti-De Sitter is just where lambda is negative. Okay, it's a more bizarre space, it's got negative vacuum energy in a sense. Okay, so now we actually know, given this, we know three possible behaviors for the matter, right? Constant, A to the minus 3, A to the minus 4. And I'm just going to write rho equals rho matter 0 a to the 3 plus rho radiation 0. Well, maybe I'll do it this way. Let's write it as constant for the matter over a cubed, constant for the radiation over a to the 4th plus lambda, which is a constant. Okay, so that's a universe with matter, radiation, and lambda, and you can just add them. That's the total density of the universe. So now we want to analyze the solutions of this equation for arbitrary amounts of matter, radiation, and lambda. And that's actually surprisingly easy to do. Even though it's more of a pain to find the analytic solutions, you can see the qualitative behavior quite easily. Okay, so the first thing, so you see in this equation I've got a relationship between A dot and A. Rho is now just expressed in terms of some constants and A. And so let's reorganize this equation to be my, I'm going to bring that A dot squared term to the, I'm going to bring this term to the left-hand side. So this is minus A dot squared, it's plus A dot squared minus 8 pi g over 3 rho A squared is equal to minus k. Okay, so I've just reorganized the equation. How do I think of this equation? This is nothing but, do you recognize this equation at all? What does that remind you of? An equation like that. I've got a velocity squared plus some function of the coordinate. A what? More general than that. What's the expression for the energy of a particle? Energy of a particle has coordinate x, right? So we say it's a half m x dot squared plus v of x. Right? That's the energy of a particle, kinetic and potential. So that's all I have here. I've got a, this is the kinetic energy associated with a scale factor. It's just an analogy, okay? Don't read anything into this kinetic energy, not a physical quantity. Just an analogy. A dot squared is kinetic energy. This is potential energy. And this is a constant. The sum of the two is constant. Okay? That's enough to tell you how to analyze this equation. Because what we'll do is call this the effective potential, which depends on A. Okay, so this is the analog of that guy. The mass is 2, and V is minus 8 pi g over rho A squared. So now we can do everything graphically, and we don't need to actually solve the differential equation, which in general you can't. In general, there are no closed solutions, but you can easily see the behavior. So let's graph V effective of A versus A. So I just think about a particle and a potential. That's all I have to think about. First of all, if I had lambda alone, right, rho would be constant. So V effective looks like minus A squared. Okay, minus 8 pi G over 3 lambda A squared. That's what having a lambda would look like. And so now I can look at this equation and I can ask, are there any solutions of that equation? What's the behavior of a particle in a potential like this? Okay, how does it behave? Well, the first thing you see is that the result depends on k. Right? Now, minus k is the energy of this particle. Now, if the energy is negative, that means it's a conserved quantity, right, energy? So I can always just graph the energy here as some line. The energy is the sum of the potential plus the kinetic. So here's the potential. This must be the kinetic. And this is the total energy, which is just equal to minus k. Okay, so I've assumed k is positive here. I've assumed k is plus 1. What is the behavior of a physical particle with that energy in this potential? Anyone tell me? What does it do? Yeah, it just it comes in from here. Its kinetic energy decreases. It turns around, and it goes back out to infinity. Okay, it's just a ball rolling on a hill. Rolls up the hill, stationary. Rolls off to infinity. Okay? And as it goes off to infinity, of course, the scale factor will go exponentially with time. It goes like e to the root 8 pi g over 3 lambda times t. Okay, so we've just analyzed the most general possible trajectory with k equals plus 1. What about k equals 0? K equals 0 means energy is 0. Okay, so in this case, the particle comes in, A decreases to 0, but you've only just got enough energy to reach 0, okay, and then you stop. So you reach A equals 0. So in fact, along this trajectory, the exact solution is exponential, with, say, coming in would be A going like e to the minus t. And as t goes to plus infinity, I reach this point. Okay, so that's k equals 0. K equals minus 1 is a trajectory like this. And basically what's going to happen is as I run into infinity, I'm going to asymptotically tend to a proportional. A will vanish like t. And this will make A will vanish like t. Okay? Something else happens here, something else a little strange. This turns out to be a coordinate singularity. Okay? I won't describe that. So that's the most general universe with lambda only. And now let's do something more interesting. So let's put in some matter and radiation. So rho, remember, rho is equal to cm over a cubed plus cr over a to the fourth plus lambda. So minus rho a squared for the matter will look like minus 1 over a. So I've got to add something to this curve, which is minus 1 over a. So if I put in matter, then I've got minus 1 over a here. That's what the matter does. Minus a squared is what the lambda did. And that's my combined, that's my effective potential for matter and lambda. Okay? Now, tell me where Einstein's static universe is. On the top. And tell me what's wrong with it. It's not stable. Okay. That's the Einstein static universe. Okay, so k, you notice k has to be plus 1, because k has got to be positive. The energy of this point is negative. So if you're going to sit here forever, you have to have k equals plus 1. So that tells you it has to be a sphere. So it's not infinite. Okay. So Einstein's static universe is not possible for an infinite universe. It has to be a sphere, a three-sphere. It sits there. The lambda is gravitationally repulsive. You see, this lambda is trying to push you to large A. Okay. The matter is trying to pull you to small a. Okay. Matter is attractive. Lambda is repulsive. And the balance between them is a static universe. But it's not stable, because if the size of the universe, the sphere, if it got a little bit bigger, then the repulsion for lambda, then the matter density goes down because it's got bigger. But the lambda repulsion is as big as ever. And so the lambda takes you off to infinity. Gets a little bit smaller, the matter's more dense. Now the matter wins over lambda, and you collapse to singularity. So this is the matter. And then radiation is similar to matter, but it's so rho a squared goes like 1 over a squared. So at small a, that will dominate. It goes like minus 1 over a squared. That's the radiation. Okay. Now, where is our universe today? Does anybody know? What's our universe in this picture? Because our universe has matter, radiation, and lambda. All these things are there, observationally. In fact, that is everything in the universe. So what does anyone know what K is for our universe? Almost zero, okay? So observations show that K is very small. And so, in fact, our universe is doing this. It's close to this line. We don't know if it's on the line, but it's close to it. Okay? So at very early times, when the radiation dominated, when this term dominated the effective potential, then you get A going like t to the 1/2. The scale factor grow like the square root of t. I think you did that in the homework. There is a singularity at t equals 0. That's a real curvature singularity. The Ricci scalar is 1 over t squared. And so that goes to infinity at small t, at t equals 0. So we came out of a singularity. Okay, you can. It's almost, it's a bit similar to the, you know, in the black hole, white hole picture. We live in the white hole. Okay, it's roughly speaking. The analogy is not perfect, but we directly came from a singularity, which we can see. Okay, so experiments to be done over the next few decades measuring gravitational waves will actually look right at the singularity. There's nothing, there's no cosmic censorship of this singularity. Okay, we can see it. Yeah. Unknown. K is within a few. The way you have to measure it is to say, what is the ratio between this term and this term? Okay, that's the way it's defined observationally. And that's a parameter called, so basically I take this equation, what we do is we divide by the, this is called the Hubble constant, A dot over A. And so I just divide by the left-hand side, and I get 1 equals to rho over this quantity squared, that's called omega matter. And then I get this quantity over A dot over A squared, omega k. And so these are two dimensionless numbers. Observationally, omega k is omega k. I forget the precise numbers, but it's something like between 0.03 and minus 0.03. So it's bounded, but we don't know. So this is one of the great challenges of observational cosmology, is to measure this more precisely. Okay, so by definition, omega matter is close to 1. I mean, if you've shown this term is small, and if you believe the Friedman equation, then this thing has to be near 1. Now, all the observations so far are completely consistent with the Friedman equation, but you have to have lambda. You have to have lambda in the universe, observationally. This was the big discovery of the last 12 or so years, was that this lambda is not zero. So in fact, if you work out omega matter is the ratio of this term divided of the 8 pi g over 3 rho matter to the left-hand side. Omega matter is about point. Wow, this is close to 1, actually. I won't say any more. Matter consists of dark matter and baryonic matter. The sum of it is about 1. This term is rather small. This is about 10 to the minus 4 in omega. So the contribution to omega is close to 1 for the both types of matter. Radiation is only 10 to the minus 4. Oh, sorry, what am I talking about? Omega matter is about 0.3, sorry. Lambda is about 0.7. And then this 0.3 is about 0.25 dark matter, 0.05 ordinary matter. And so this is the dark energy. Okay, yeah.
Our k is close to zero. Does that mean our universe would keep on expanding forever no matter what side of the line?
Exactly. Yeah, good point. So you see, if k is, if k was positive, then the energy of this particle traveling in the well is negative, And then you have two types of trajectories. You have one that does this. You can roll in the hill, up the hill, and roll back. You also have one like this. Okay, this is a universe that came out of a singularity and recollapsed to the singularity before it got big. This one is a bouncing universe. It comes in from a large size, comes to some finite A, and then goes back. Or you can have ones that go above the barrier, so they just, like our one, you know, or you could have a contracting universe that just came in and ended with a singularity. So that's the complete set of universes that are possible with this type of matter. If you put in anti-de Sitter, you see, you could say, well, what if lambda were negative? So that's easy to see what that does. So say I put in an anti-de Sitter with matter and radiation, that would do this, right? The effective potential goes like plus A squared. And now you can see every universe comes out of a singularity, turns around, and goes back to a singularity.
Is there any reason why our universe should be going from singularity to infinite expansion and not come from infinite size and go back?
That's a great mystery that any theory has to solve. So one way of saying it is that there is an arrow. There are several arrows of time in the universe. One of them is the direction of expansion, defined by, you know, is it getting bigger? The other one is a thermodynamic arrow of time, that is entropy increasing in that direction. The third one, which is a psychological arrow of time, that we only are aware of things in our past, that defines an arrow of time as well. So obviously, we hope that all three of these agree for some fundamental reason, okay? But there is no real explanation. So this is one of the sort of issues people debate about inflation. Okay, so inflation is basically just an idea that there was a temporary lambda, which is very huge. And so the consequence of that is you take a tiny little universe, little piece of space, it could even be quite irregular, take a little piece of space, blow it up exponentially with this effect, and that could be our whole universe. That's the whole idea of inflation. Some people were claiming, or have claimed, it's become traditional to claim, that this solves all the cosmological puzzles, okay, including the arrow of time, the why is it big and flat, and even where the density variations came from. But I've always been a skeptic. And I'm writing a paper right now that shows that isn't true. The generic universe does not inflate for long. Yeah.
Does that imply that the universe is infinite or finite?
No, it just doesn't. It sort of declares it to be an uninteresting question. Okay, because it says, imagine I've got this is the picture. I'm not advocating it, but the picture is you have some very lumpy, random universe, very small, some small region. Then you picked a little region of it, and you just blew it up by a massive factor. You have to blow it up by about a factor of 10 to the power 30, okay, to make it agree with what we see. And then you say everything outside that patch we can't see anyway, and so we won't worry about it.
On the board, that picture...
This picture just assumed homogeneity. Right? So this picture is not valid for describing an inhomogeneous universe. This is at best, this can be a local approximation to some universe that's inhomogeneous.
But can you say anything about the finiteness or infiniteness of our universe?
No. We see a finite region because we can see back to the surface of last scattering, which is the surface upon which the temperature fell low enough that the microwave photons were emitted to us without any scattering. So we see the surface. It's 13.7 billion years away, light years away from us. That's as far as we can see, 13.7 billion light years. Beyond that surface is actually the singularity. So beyond that surface is another 400,000 light years, very short distance. compared to what we already see. And if we go out that distance, we will see the singularity. But we can only do that with gravitational waves. Can't do that with electromagnetic waves. So if I draw a space-time picture, oh, I never did draw the Kerr space-time, but if I do this for cosmology, conformal diagram for cosmology, it will look like this. So remember, flat space looks like that. So cosmology just looks like this. Throw away the lower half. That's the singularity. And we live here in Minkowski space, and we look back. Our past light cone just looks, it just includes the singularity, and so we can just see it. If I then draw the surface of last scattering, that's when the photons we see were emitted, that's something like this. And so this epoch of the universe is the plasma epoch. The universe is full of this dense plasma. We can't see through it with light. But with gravitational waves, we can see right through it. And so you could see the singularity.
Doesn't that mean we live on a giant sphere or not?
Yeah. Well, no, you can have a space which is locally positively curved, but then globally it can be flat. Or you know, at larger distance it can be flat or negatively curved or anything. So local observations can never tell you the global geometry.
Okay.
So, yeah.
What do you think the singularity is going to look like?
What?
When we can see the singularity, what's it going to look like?
Oh, it'll look like colliding brains, of course. We know that already. No, the point is you must make a theory of it. And our theory, based on M theory, is that singularity, the way to resolve the singularity and make sense of it, is to embed it in higher dimensions. And within a theory like M theory or string theory, and in which all the quantities at the singularity are actually finite, there are no infinities, okay, in our picture of the singularity. So, in the inflation picture, there's no attempt made to resolve the singularity. You just assume the universe somehow jumped out of this, jumped out of nothing, came out of a singularity. You can't describe it. But you assume that after a certain amount of time, it began to inflate. And you just track it from the beginning of that inflation with a sort of assumption about the initial condition. Yeah?
So that the universe just jumped out of nothing. But before the universe, there was anything. So
well, this is a big.
Well,
it's a big debate. So there are two points of view. One of them is that the universe began, and the other is that it did not begin. So, and this comes down to a question of whether you think time is fundamental. And you see, certainly if I'm doing GR, locally, at every point of a manifold, there's a direction of time. I mean, it's impossible for time to start in GR, because I just go to the moment where it started, and I draw my little piece of Minkowski space, and I say, ah, there was a time before. So it's not possible for a universe to begin in GR. Now, Stephen Hawking advocates a particular point of view according to which it did begin. But what he has to do to make that happen is to take time. So you've got we've got our function a of t, okay? Oops. And so what you do is think of t as a complex time, okay? And the singularity is here, okay? So what you do is you essentially run the time back and continue in the imaginary direction. When you continue in the imaginary direction, the manifold essentially has a plus there now. And then you have a squared of tau. This is the analytically continued a. Well, it's actually, he likes to take it to be a three-sphere. So this is ds3 squared, I guess. And then the picture is like this, that at some moment, so time was real here. This is t. Before the surface, time was imaginary. And then basically you can round it off. Okay, so here the space, this really is a Riemannian manifold. And so essentially his picture is that you had half of a four sphere here. Take a four sphere, take the equator, it's a three sphere. Okay, cut the four sphere on the equator, and then continue time to real values. Actually, one of the biggest difficulties in having discussions with Stephen is he calls real time imaginary time. Okay. So according to him, our time is imaginary. So he actually views it, this is just a convention, but he views this is the real time. And our time, I guess, this is the imaginary axis, and that's the real axis. So time was real, and then it goes imaginary. Anyway, so that's a picture of kind of beginning the universe. Okay. The problem is you're giving up a lot of the structure of general relativity when you make time go space-like. You lose all the Hamiltonian constraints. Path integral doesn't make any sense anymore. And besides which, the predictions of this are just wrong.
And why should you say that it is a three-sphere?
Just for simplicity.
It could be
I mean, it's a beautiful picture, okay? So his picture of, this comes down to the ancient debate between Parmenides and Heraclitus in ancient Greece, okay? Heraclitus believed that change, they were wondering about change, you know, people like Zeno and all these people, why does the world change? And their conclusion that change is a result of tension between opposites. You have opposite things, and they pull on each other, and that's why the universe changes. So Parmenides said, no, that's all an illusion. Change is just an illusion. You know, I should think about the history of the universe. That's just given. You know, change is just a fiction. Once you're given a universe, that's it. You know, how can you speak about a change? You should think about space and time. Parmenides was kind of a predecessor to Minkowski, right? He said there's space-time. Now, Hawking takes it one step further, and he says that actually time is Euclidean, not Lorentzian. Lorentzian means with the signature minus plus plus plus. Hawking says the fundamental thing is Euclidean. The signature is plus 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 plus. So his picture of the universe is that it looks like a four sphere, okay, with some fluctuations, okay? So there's some quantum four-sphere that sits there, and you have a measure, like a thermal statistical mechanical measure, and you do the path, Euclidean path integral, and you compute anything you like on the four-sphere. And then what you do is you continue time out of this four-sphere into the Lorentzian region. You basically go up the imaginary axis, and then you compute all the correlators or observables or anything up there. So,
behind the sphere universe.
And
then if we continue to like our real space time, it's still a three sphere, right?
Yeah, that's because that's the. You can argue, it's not terribly convincing, but, let me see what. Okay, so if you accept that the primordial object is a four sphere, and if you accept that you want to continue time to the Lorentzian region, there's actually only one way to do it, which is that you cut the four sphere here and you continue on that axis. This is the only way to start with a real metric and stay real. Okay? You can sort of see that because the four sphere looks like this. D omega 3 squared. So if that's the metric on a four sphere, and if I say theta is equal to pi over 2, so I go to the equator, this angle is theta, I go to the equator, which is pi over 2, and then I set pi over 2 plus it, then this guy becomes minus dt squared, and this guy becomes cosh squared t d omega 3 squared, and this is the De Sitter space. That's the De Sitter solution for k equals plus 1. Okay, so you just by this analytic continuation, you get an inflating universe. That's basically the picture he wants. Yeah.
Neil, I was wondering, there's on both the three sphere and the four sphere, there's no complex structure. You can only form a complex structure on a two sphere or a six sphere. So how can you analytically continue if you don't have a complex structure?
The idea is what do you need the complex structure for fermions or?
Only for time. S of tango is imaginary, then you'll have to have a complex structure on the mantle.
No, you don't need a complex structure to continue, to analytically continue. I mean, that's an example. So just take, any sphere. I can do this for two sphere, three sphere, four sphere. So literally the idea is that I consider the coordinates on the sphere, and then the one thing you want is that the metric is real on both the Euclidean section. He calls it a section. So I think about my coordinate space as actually four-dimensional, but complex. So I think of the metric as a function of four complex coordinates. It's hard to picture an eight-dimensional space. Okay? And then you say, I want to take a section of that eight-dimensional space, and I'll say that those are my coordinates on spacetime. Okay, so the metric is going to be a function on that section of eight-dimensional space. So you're allowed to shift the section around. Okay, but you want to keep the metric real, otherwise you don't know what you're doing. Well, it's arguable, maybe you don't know what you're doing anyway. But at the very least, you want to keep it, you want to keep it real so that you can measure distances and do calculations. But so to make it real, the only way to make it real, you see, if you've got an analytic function, let's say I've got some function, and I want to go along the real axis, and then I want to go imaginary, and I want this to stay real. The only possibility is that function is even around this point. See, if it's t squared, and I say t goes to I tor, then it'll go to minus tor squared. It's still real. That's the only way you can do it. So you have to arrange that the derivative of this function is zero. In fact, you have to have the functions even, but the derivative must certainly be zero at that point. And that's true at the equator. So if the sine squared theta has zero derivative at the equator. That's why I went to theta to pi over 2 and continued, and I got a real answer. So it's kind of unique how you do this, but you can do it for any sphere.
I just want to ask, is there any relationship between this and instantons?
Yes. Good question. This four sphere is called an instanton. So an instanton is a solution of the Euclidean signature field equations. This is relevant in field quantum field theory. Often we make time imaginary just as a technical device, also called a Wick rotation. When you do quantum field theory, it's a Wick rotation. So in quantum field theory, making time imaginary is a very powerful and important technique. And the solution of the field equations for imaginary time is called an instanton. So this is a cosmological instanton. And so if you look on the web, you'll find the Hawking-Tirok instanton, which describes the beginning of an inflationary universe. And there are actually a number of these instantons. But the simplest one, conceptually, is this four-sphere, and that's really the picture that Hawking has in mind. So I worked on this for quite a while. There are lots of technical issues with it. Like I mentioned, you don't get the proper constraints, and path integrals not well defined. But so I did that for a while. Didn't seem to be working. And so then I've been working on the idea that no, time is real, and the physical time is a real thing. And the real puzzle there is to resolve the singularity. That you're looking at the singularity, you must basically invent some new physics which is capable of describing that singularity. And in fact, Roger Penrose has just written a book about this. What comes out of this new point of view, it's not so new, but this point of view is that the universe can be cyclical. Once you've resolved the singularity, then you can have a big bang, then you can have another big bang, and the universe just goes happily through it.
So I saw a talk by him last year where he talks about the universe that expands forever, but it's still cycling.
Yeah. Yes, so our picture of a cyclic universe was that it in a sense was the same. Our picture is that they're colliding brains, okay? And these brains collide, that's the Big Bang, and then the brains expand so they collide by moving in a higher dimension. They expand within their own dimension, okay, which is perpendicular to this. So the 3D we live in is on the brain, and that just expands, and it actually expands forever. But from time to time, they collide, and that's what makes the Big Bang. And then they expand, and then they collide, and they expand. So the universe is infinite, eternal, and cyclical, okay, in our picture. So his picture is that, but our picture has a singularity. The way our picture works is that the brain collision makes a singularity and the universe comes out of singularity. Penrose is trying to make a simpler picture, okay, where you take our universe, which will be dominated by vacuum energy in the future, and it will blow up like A going like exponentially with time. Okay, A will proportional to E to some number times T. So you take this to blow up to infinity, but then what he notices is that a universe like that is conformally flat. Okay, so that means the metric is just a quantity times flat space. Okay, where the quantity happens to diverge, but anyway. Now Penrose likes these conformal diagrams, as you know, the Penrose diagrams. So he's happy to throw away that conformal factor, okay? And so basically what he does is follow this space to its future and then looks at the conformal diagram and, in fact, it will look like if I draw the universe as a sphere, for example, doesn't matter too much on that. He draws the conformal diagram. It looks like this. There's space and time, and that's the end of time. And then he glues the Big Bang on there. Okay? So he is saying that A going to E to the number times T matches onto this other solution where A goes like T to the 1/2. So A equals infinity is matching onto A equals 0. That's his picture. And the only reason he can even wildly conceive of that is he's quite happy to pull conformal factors out of the metric and ignore them. Yeah.
Is his action the Einstein-Hilbert action?
No, he hasn't got one. apparently, I haven't seen this book, but it's just come out. It's a popular book on a cyclic universe, but it has a mathematical appendix. And Lee Smolin has a copy of it. He's reviewing it, but I haven't seen it. So I'm very curious, because I've seen Roger give many talks about this. Every time I asked him, what are your equations? How are you going to propagate things across this matching surface? You haven't got equations. And, you know, he sort of said, well, I think you can probably invent some equations. But you see, Roger believes very profoundly in causality. That's what he believes is the heart of relativity, light cones and causality and all that. All the rest, the Einstein field equations, you know, the metric, it's kind of an afterthought. So he's quite happy to give up the Einstein equations on this surface. Anyway, this is a very active field of research, and as far-fetched as it seems, it's actually amazing that these ideas are testable. Within the next 20 or 30 years, we'll be able to measure gravitational waves that will allow us to look at the singularity and see who, if any of us, was right. So it's not a sterile intellectual exercise. Okay, I better end. So thank you.